The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the century of lies.
Happy birthday to me, happy birthday to me, happy birthday to... Oh. Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. Century of Lies is a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org.
Oh, well, I'm Chris Bennett. I'm a cannabis activist up here in Canada. I've been writing about the role of cannabis in history, particularly in magic and religion for, I don't know, over 25 years, I guess. And also run an entheobotanical shop up here, the Urban Shaman. And, yeah, that's kind of what I'm doing and who I am. Well, you know, cannabis is, the use of cannabis for ritual purposes is older than any existing religion. We know for at least from archaeological evidence, just regarding burnt cannabis, let alone things like hemp fiber and things like that. But just on the evidence of the ritual using of burning cannabis, inhaling the fumes, that goes back about 5,500 years, so it's a very old thing, and it can be found in diverse cultures. We have evidence of cannabis in ancient China, particularly among Taoists. We have evidence throughout the Mideast, Assyria, Babylon, and probably what I'm most well known for is this research into the Hebrew term cannabossum, which was used in the incenses and anointing oils, and which I put a case forth to show that this was used into Christian times. As well, cannabis, through new archaeological evidence in the Bactria Margiana archaeological complex, as well as finds in China among Indo-Europeans, and Scythian finds of cannabis, both burnt and used as a beverage, it's really looking like cannabis was the ancient haoma of the Parsi or Zoroastrian religion, as well as the Soma of the Vedic religion. And there's no other plant or wine or anything like that that has been used so much in religion as cannabis has.
It's fascinating stuff, and it's some would say, some might argue that, well, if that had been going on for so long, wouldn't everybody just know that?
You know, the Dark Ages came along, a lot of information was lost, but some people do know it. You know what I mean? Things like Assyrian references to cannabis and Mesopotamian references to cannabis are well established. It's not unknown in those fields of study. And emerging archaeological evidence is really changing the way that we look at this and look at cannabis. There's just been so many interesting finds over the last few decades of cannabis at different sites. Sorry, that's my parrot there chirping in the background, that it is becoming more well-known, you know, but things like the, you know, cannabossum, for instance, that's based on etymological evidence tracing the modern word cannabis back through history, and also taking a look at the similar term cannabu that was used in Assyria. And the way that cannabis was used there was identical to the way the Hebrews would have been using it, anointing oils, incenses, ritual purposes in the temple, as well as medicine. So, yeah, it's becoming increasingly well-known and increasingly accepted that cannabis was a major player in the ancient world.
And could you speak for a moment about the idea of the mysteries in various religions throughout? We've had the I know that they've had the sort of people are initiated into the understandings and the learnings and the teachings, and these become known as the mysteries. It's not a puzzle to solve.
Well, I think that religion itself, you know, starts with the shamanic exploration of psychoactive plants generally. This is pretty common throughout the world, still taking place in places like Africa and South America, where people are ingesting psychoactive substances and interpreting that experience as some sort of divine revelation. Same thing in the ancient world, you know, when people came across these plants and they affected consciousness, this was seen as some sort of either spiritual possession or divine messenger of the gods. And so this isn't, from an anthropological perspective, this is quite a normal development of human consciousness. So the mysteries were basically, you know, taking people out of their everyday consciousness And with set and setting, oftentimes, you know, ritual intent created by songs, music, setting of the temple atmosphere with statues that represented deities and things like that. And then the ingestion of these psychoactive substances combined with that threw people into deep mystical states where they felt they were getting into contact with something higher than just their own personal consciousness.
You have a new book in which you're talking about something that people might define as the supernatural.
Well, you know, definitely dealing with magic and the occult. The new book's called Liber 420, Cannabis Arcanum, and it's going to focus on the occult use of cannabis, generally from, you know, the medieval period forward, although at the beginning of the book I lay a foundation of agent use, because the ritual use of cannabis in the medieval time forward really was a development of that earlier use, a rediscovery of cannabis through the Crusades, actually. You know, there had been kind of a dry period in spirituality, the great dark ages when the Catholic Church was dominating much of Europe, and there was no other sort of religious philosophy beyond reading the Bible, and most people couldn't even read it, so they were just told about the Bible through priests and bishops and those sorts of people. And through the Crusades, so there, you know, this became quite a dry sort of religion, and people started wanting more, and this led to a decision to go into the Holy Land, rediscover the Holy Land, and while in the Holy Land, they rediscovered cannabis through Islamic use. But, you know, cannabis had played a role in ancient Europe as well. I should establish that we've, you know, found evidence of cannabis at Celtic and Druidic sites all over Europe. And according to the Encyclopedia of Indo-European Studies, cannabis was very prevalent a number of times throughout ancient European history, both as a fiber and as a ritual substance. But this ritual use came back into Europe through magic in a large way. Books like the Arabic book, The Picatrix, which was in 11th century, it's called Picatrix in Europe. It's a Gayat al-Hakim in the Islamic world. But this was an Islamic magical text from about the 11th century, and it was translated into Latin and made its way into Europe around the 13th century. It was very influential in the magical tradition, this Arabic grimoire. And it's a lot of like planetary magic. So it's like, you know, based on the magic of the stars and certain plants and incenses and colors and minerals were all associated with the different planets. And cannabis played a really important role, along with other drugs as well, opium and mandrake and henbane and other substances can be found in the Picatrix. And it was generally used here in invocation. So they would burn cannabis with other substances, sometimes mixed with blood, and because they felt that the blood gave the deities invoked a physical means of manifesting. And so they would, you know, subfumigate. That means like create a really smoky atmosphere through burning of cannabis and other substances. And then in the smoke itself, they would start to see a vision. This vision was the invoked deity that was called down through this means. So this really inspired a lot of European magic. And we have later grimoires like the Sefer Raziel from the 16th century, or the Book of Oberon, as well as the Book of Magic and Invocation. These are all 16th century texts that have cannabis in them. Usually the cannabis in these later texts seems to have been combined with magic mirrors. And these were either concave mirrors or a flat black surface. And people would take cannabis, they often used it in an oil, very similar to the way that I've suggested for the Hebrews and the Christians' use of cannabis, and sometimes burning it as well. And then after taking the substance, they would stare into these mirrors until visions started to appear. And, you know, it's basically like a projector for the unconscious mind, the subconscious mind. And it's interesting because this form of magic was very popular right into the 19th, early 20th century. And we have figures like Louis Alphonse Cagné and Pascal Beverly Randolph and Dupoté and other figures of 19th century occultism using the same method centuries after the publication of, not the publication, but the passing around of manuscripts like the Sefer Raziel or the Book of Magic and Invocation, or the Book of Oberon, all these various magical texts. So this carried on for some time, and it also played a really big role in the development of what we know as spiritualism. That's like seances, table rapping, you know, that type of stuff. Cannabis was really big in the circles that started that trip in the 19th century, like Cahagné and Helena Blavatsky and Pascal Randolph.
And this is, and again, going back to the when I was asking about mysteries, in a sense, I mean, there's the Eleusinian mysteries where they were shut down by the Christians in the beginning of the, in the Dark Ages, exactly. But, you know, they had been celebrated the story of Demeter and Persephone. And at the end of it, people no longer feared death. They understood the cycle of life, you know, death and birth.
You know, cannabis since ancient times, like, you know, you got to remember that, like, people can't base this stuff on their own experience with cannabis. For one thing, these people weren't using cannabis, you know, for the most part, these people weren't using cannabis recreationally. It was just used in these type of ritual settings. And also, oftentimes, very powerful extracts of cannabis were used. So potent, they'd knock you out for a day or two, you know what I mean? And this goes back to Zoroastrian use, where figures like Ardu, Virak, and Vishtaspa, and we know this because there's written records of this that refer to Bhanga, which is the name of cannabis back in the ancient Parsi language, used for this particular purpose, often mixed with wine, which was a common way of ingesting throughout the period. And they would take such strong doses that they'd be, you know, knocked out, and they'd have visions while they were knocked out, dreams. And they interpreted these visions and dreams as the body leaving, I mean, the soul leaving the body and going off and, you know, seeing the wonders of heaven and the horrors of hell and things like that. And when the people woke up, they would relate what they had seen. And this was like a major source of divine knowledge. So this separation of what they thought of the soul and the body through these visionary substances, and other substances besides cannabis were obviously used as well, were kind of like a mini-death, you know? And since the soul was able to travel free from the body in these states and see these things, then obviously at death this was what happened, they believed. And this gave rise to a lot of the beliefs we have about an afterlife.
And people might, there are probably people who could be forgiven in this modern day who might think, well, you know, that's just these cultures, they were simple, but, you know, we have, you know, our Bible, by gosh, we, you know, we can all just read this and understand it. Except that many years ago, before people were allowed to have a translation of the Bible into, many years ago, it was only a few centuries, that the Bible could only be in Latin, and Latin was a language that was only understood by a certain class of people, and largely the priests. So you had that priest class as a, you know, standing between, and then was opened up, and suddenly the mysteries, what I was, you know, are revealed in part to the public. I mean, Is there any difference really between the sacred mystical texts of that sort or the Latin Bible back hundreds of years ago before people were allowed to read Latin? I mean, is there a difference really?
Well, you know, the big difference is the intermediaries of the priests and bishops and pope and that type of stuff placed between the people and that spiritual access, you know, to partake of psychoactive substances and claim a religious experience would have been heresy. It would have got you burnt at the stake, much like the witches and others were burnt at the stake throughout the period, medieval period, right? So it's like about direct access to the divine versus being told about it. You know what I mean? It was like the Bible almost, in a sense, represents fossilized spirituality, a memory of it, you know? And but, you know, even in the Bible, like the Book of Revelation, John takes a scroll, he puts it in his mouth that turns bitter in his stomach, and then he begins to prophesy. So he ingested something. A similar thing takes place in the Book of Ezekiel, where he eats something and then begins to prophesy from ingesting it. So it's pretty clear that they were using these types of methods, but it was not something that the layperson or even the priestcraft, they kind of had been suppressed for so long that they literally forgot about these avenues of spirituality, direct spirituality.
You are listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. We're speaking with Chris Bennett, a scholar, researcher, and writer based up in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, discussing the history of marijuana and spirituality. Basically, the ideas that we accept as perfectly natural and given when we're looking at some society that's not mainstream Western Europe, when we think of, you know, those, oh, well, that was then. When we start looking at our own, the idea of some kind of mysticism or different layers of meaning or, you know, hidden meanings for an initiate, maybe it's just the people I run into, but I think there's a degree of resistance. And what your research is basically showing is, no, that Western culture, Western European culture, and even our religions are no different than any of the others that have developed over the centuries. We have these mysteries, we have these traditions, and these rituals, and sometimes information gets lost. But I mean, that's what you're doing, is looking.
Well, I think it's the perennial religion. This is the natural way things go. You know. Agent man wanders around and checks out his environment and samples different things, and then some things have a potent effect, and these things were imbued with spirit, particularly imbued with spirit. And this is just the way it is in the world, you know. It's like there's very, you know, the only cultures that haven't used entheogens of some sort, I think, are like the Eskimos, where there wasn't any really growing out there, but they had other methods of like breathing exercises and things like that, ritual breathing and things that threw them into mystic states, you know what I mean? These types of states, you know, it's not just the ingested plants. You could go sit in the dark in a cave for a few days and not eat, you know, and have a mystical experience. Sometimes a fever, like in the case of Black Elk's Great Vision, he was had a huge fever, and he was thrown into these states. But certain plants affect certain receptors in the brain, and the experiences that we got as a result of this were deeply influential on our spirituality, if not the very core origins of them.
And you mentioned a word that I want to make sure people hear again and understand, because this is the word entheogen.
It's, yeah, that means spirit created from within, and this is a term that Professor Karl Rock and Jonathan Ott and others have placed on psychoactive substances used in some sort of ritual way in order to get into contact with the spiritual world. And so that's a modern term. Instead of using the terms like psychedelic or hallucinogen that are more loaded, this is directly in references to those same sorts of substances used for spiritual or religious purposes. Here, let me give you an example of how people themselves have kind of interpreted this. These examples here are from a book written in the 1840s in France. It's called Sanctuary of Spiritualism, Study of the Human Soul, by this guy Louis Alphonse Cahagné. And Cahagné was a very important figure in 19th century occultism as well as spiritualism. He gave 3 grams of hashish mixed into strong coffee to about 15 participants, and then they recorded their experiences, you know. And these people reported, you know, seeing people, long-lost dead relatives, traveling into huge geometrically formed cathedrals, which are of light, which are kind of like the DMT type visions people are seeing now, and other things. And as Cahagné explained of these visions, he said, "These phenomena demonstrated to me that these hallucinations, so-called by all those who have taken this beverage and on whom similar effects have been produced, were intended to establish sacred truths, especially by directing towards them the serious observations of all studious men. I conclude that this state is the spiritual state we shall enter on quitting the material state, and that we may establish by the propagation of this state the most sublime doctrine that ever existed. It is my conviction that hashish develops in us the spiritual state in which each may find disclosures answering to his inclinations. This is not one of these ecstatics who, after emerging, there is not one of these ecstatics who, after emerging from this state, has not felt a desire to thank God for such an initiation, and each has found himself penetrated with these truths." So these are really powerful experiences that really leave an impression on people after they've had them, you know? And I'll give you another example from, like, the Book of Oberon, where, as I mentioned, you know, cannabis was mixed with Archangel, which I believe is Angel's Trumpet, and was a very, very powerful hallucination. And this was used as a means of invoking spirits into the magic mirror. You know, so this is like a common way of doing it. Same with the ancient Zoroastrians or the ancient Jews. They ingested these substances. Moses goes into the tent of the meeting, and he takes this holy anointing oil, which, according to the recipe, had about 9 pounds of cannabossum. This is this term that Sula Bennett first suggested was a reference to cannabis and was mistranslated as calamus when the Hebrew texts were translated into Latin. Mixed with myrrh and cinnamon and other substances into about a gallon and a half of olive oil. Every time that Moses speaks to the Lord, he covers himself in this oil, and THC is fatty soluble and can pass through the skin, which is a big organ. As well, he would take some of this oil and he would place it on the altar of incense. And the whole time he's doing this, he's inside a little enclosed space called the tent of the meeting. And he would actually speak to the Lord in the pillar of smoke over the incense altar. This is capnomancy, scrying in smoke, seeing a vision in smoke. And he would ponder on a question, and then the answers would kind of start flowing back into his subconscious, and he would take those as literal sayings from God. And so this is like the very common type of experience that humanity used to have.
And that is... You know, I suppose is part of the point. These people think of some of these experiences as very much out there and oh, so strange. And well, people in ancient times might take a plant substance and go on a trip, and maybe they'd be given.
Well, they didn't have any idea about THC molecules attaching themselves to the endocannabinoid system in the body or anything like that. There wasn't any sort of science behind it. There was just the plant and the effect, and you know that effect was obviously coming through some sort of spiritual means in their minds, you know. So it wasn't all explained away with science, you know. But even our own consciousness is really just has to do with receptors and molecules and chemicals in our bodies and stuff like that. Our consciousness itself, and the only reason that these psychoactive substances affect us is because they're similar to some of those naturally occurring things, in the case of cannabis, to the endocannabinoids, natural endogenous cannabinoids of the human body. The cannabinoids of the cannabis plant are able to attach themselves to those same receptors, and that's why they affect us. So there's some sort of correlation between us and these plants, you know. It's like we've co-evolved in order to be able to use them.
And although we didn't have the scientific knowledge, there would have been people all throughout history. There have been some people who have understood these things, that information gets passed along. Someone learns it because of experience, and they pass it along. And that's that initiation into the mysteries, which is where this, I mean, in a sense, when people use the words mystery or mysticism and magic, there are going to be some people who suddenly decide, oh, never mind. Whereas really, you're just describing the way that people experienced the things that they, just the way that people experience things and how they interpret them. I mean, if you eat some bread and you go on this amazing psychedelic journey, it's because there was some rye ergot fungus, and it's the ergots from which we get LSD. So, yep, that's what happened. But if you're just a person with that, you know, if you're a person living hundreds of years ago without... You know, you can't read or write, and you know everything. All that you know is what you were told by your parents, who are similarly uneducated, or the priest, who is the one who controls access to all the knowledge. Then, it was probably a miracle. It was God speaking to you. No, it was just this mushroom that you ate, or this bread that you ate, that made you think.
A big point here is how the substance is introduced, too. So you can't underplay the role of set and setting in these situations. You know, when cannabis was a major medicine in the 19th and early 20th century, in all sorts of different extracts and things, people would take these substances and they would just feel better because they had taken their medicine, you know what I mean? And the effects were thought, oh, that's the medicine working, you know. There's very few, you know, there are some, but there are very few accounts of people, you know, having powerful experiences from Lilly Pharmaceutical extract of cannabis or Tilden's extract of cannabis or whatever one they took, although there are some. For the most part, people just felt better because that was the mindset. And I think this is particularly true of cannabis. I think it was Andrew Weil who termed it as an active placebo because it is active, but it's also like what you think about it is how it affects you. It's your intent. And so when you know you're sitting and you're smoking herb for playing some video games, on the TV, you're not necessarily going to have the same sort of experience of, say, a sadhu in India who bangs it off his third eye in honor of the god Shiva and then sits down to his asanas and starts doing his yogic postures. You know, they're going to have two different effects simply because of the mindset of the ingesters.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Chris Bennett, scholar, researcher, writer, and a friend, and really a really fascinating stuff, and we don't have enough time, so I'm going to have you back on soon. But tell me now, again, your new book and also some closing thoughts, and if you have a Twitter account that people can follow you on and a blog where people can find out more of what you're writing and that kind of stuff. Gosh, I haven't been up to Vancouver in a long time, but I'm Urban Shaman. You've got a shop there in Vancouver, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. You can find me on cannabisculture.com. I have a blog on there. I post a lot of historical stuff on the blog, texts and whatnot as well. Add me on Facebook. If you're on Facebook, I'm always posting stuff on there. And my shop, The Urban Shaman, is I specialize in plants like peyote, ayahuasca, kratom, things like that, a variety of psychoactive substances. I believe humanity has a natural right to the plants of the earth, and I try to celebrate that natural right to the plants of the earth as much as possible. And when we're talking about that natural right, which is like our right to air and water, we're talking about a plant like cannabis. We're talking about a plant that humanity has had a relationship with, not for thousands of years, but for tens of thousands of years. And it's a fundamental human right that we have access to cannabis and other medicines of the earth. And my new book is Liber 420, Cannabis Arcana. My last book, which you can find on Amazon, is Cannabis and the Soma Solution. Covers a lot of ground about the role of cannabis in the ancient world. Check it out. I've also got some really good videos on YouTube. If you search my name, Chris Bennett and Cannabis, you'll find a variety of videos, but I've got interviews with people like Professor Carl Rock, Dr. Ethan Russo, Dr. David Hillman, Mike Aldrich, and others on the history of cannabis and go into a lot of detail in those videos.
Fantastic. Folks, do check out Chris's stuff. It's fascinating, it's eye-opening, and it's important. It's, as I say, to know where you're going, you have to know where you are and how you got there. And, you know, that whole question of how we got here is a thing that it's like an onion, peeling back layers and finally understanding, oh, that's why this all happened. You've been listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh and, of course, also at Drug Policy Facts. We'll be back next week with 30 minutes of news and information about the drug war and this century of lies. For now, for the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.